Good afternoon, everybody. I'm Elise Kling, sitting in for John Williams today. Welcome to the Wintrust Business Lunch. Pete Zimmerman is our producer. And Monday is the day that I usually am here, starting off the week with a look at some of the big business stories. So maybe what I'll do is give you a quick recap, and then we've got a great show for you today. We're going to talk with Megan Morris, who's a senior reporter at Insider.com, about Travis Kalanick and his Saudi-backed kitchen startup that is losing incredible numbers of people. Here we are. There's so many people that are looking for jobs, and they just can't seem to keep the people that they have. And we'll talk to her, with her a little bit about why. And then Jim Dulkey is the senior editor of Chicago Inno, and we've got some good tech stories coming with him, which is good, an interesting business, what's going on in that world. And then coming up at the end, of course, we'll talk to Amy Guth, who's our reporter, about all sorts of interesting things on her agenda today. So as you heard Steve say a few minutes ago, the markets are a little bit mixed. We're seeing the Dow is down just a little bit. S&P is up, though, 4,087, and NASDAQ is up as well, about 86 points. One of the big news items that I saw today that I thought was really interesting is that Apple announced, in addition to the fact that it's adopting the color yellow for anybody who wants a yellow computer, that they are going to spend $1 billion to build a huge facility that's going to specialize in artificial intelligence and machine learning in North Carolina. They expect to hire 3,000 engineers and others to work in that location. And it's kind of interesting to make that sort of huge investment. And we're seeing the big tech companies start to really put down large roots in other places. So in the beginning, it was all about coming to San Francisco and living in San Francisco. But of course, it's just gotten so much more expensive and difficult to live in San Francisco. Like, you think we have a housing shortage here in Chicago? Well, if you go out there, there's literally people are living in campers that are parked on major roads just simply because there's nowhere for them to buy. And so Apple and Google and Facebook and others, when the pandemic hit, they said, yep, go ahead and work from home. And then it became well, if you want to keep working from home, we'll just give you a pay cut. But now they're starting to turn around and make investments in other parts of the country, which I think is actually a really smart move, right? We've watched Amazon do this, building warehouses and storehouses all over the country, office supplies, they're moving. You know, the whole move to Washington, D.C. area to open up a second East Coast headquarters and the 25,000 people that they expected to hire there. But, you know, starting to see Google make a huge investment in building buildings in other parts of the country. And now we hear from Apple that they're going to open up this facility in North Carolina. Yes, I wish it were Chicago. But what we're seeing is a dispersion of really good paying jobs across the country, especially in markets where it's a lot more affordable to live and easier to find people. And I just think that as we continue this dispersal, you know, tech companies seem to be hearing what their employees are telling them, which is we want to find a place where we can own a house and raise our kids, more rural, more suburban, not so much in the city, but we want to spread out. And it's a complete reversal from where the older millennials and younger millennials were when they first entered what should have been their prime home buying year. So super interesting trend to watch and see how business catches up with it. So Insider's Megan Morris recently put out a big story about how Uber founder Travis Kalanick has been building Uber without the guardrails at a startup that's now seeing employees not be as happy as they could be. Megan joins us on the line now. Megan, welcome to the Wintrust Business Lunch. Tell me a little bit about the story that you're following. How did you happen upon it?
I have always been very interested in companies that are doing something different at scale and have really unique cultures. At Business Insider, I led our WeWork coverage for 2 years. That's a great example of a very unusual company in recent years. It's grown very quickly, amassed tons of locations and tons of employees before things totally went off the rails.
Oh, yeah.
So I was interested in thinking about what are other companies that are scaling sort of at hyper growth right now. And some folks told me Cloud Kitchens was the next thing that I should think about. They have amassed tons of properties, both across the U.S. and even internationally, and they're led by this larger-than-life leader, Uber's founder. So I wanted to look and see what's happening at this company. They're talking about changing the way that people eat, making food that you get delivered as cheap as that you cook in your home. So I thought it was just a really interesting business model that hasn't been written about very much, and I thought I'd dive in.
So let's explain that a little bit to everybody listening, because I think one of the things that happened in the pandemic that was super interesting is that restaurants had to figure out a new formula, and small, I don't even know what I would call them, startup chefs were thinking about, you know, they used to go and get a truck, right? And that's how they tested out their recipes and maybe, you know, started up their businesses, but that wasn't working either. So explain what a cloud kitchen is and what you're seeing in terms of a trend.
This concept is basically on a rocket ship growth trajectory, and not just that Cloud Kitchen is the company I wrote about. There's been a lot of venture interest in the space because, just like you pointed out, the pandemic is kind of the perfect time for this thing to take off. People are sitting at home. They're ordering delivery, not necessarily going out to food trucks like you might at lunch for work. And so people were looking for something a little different. So this kind of concept benefits both the consumer, the person who's eating the food, as well as these restaurant startups that are really keen to figure out how can they survive in this difficult environment. The concept of the ghost kitchen or dark kitchen, as they're variously called, is sort of like a WeWork for restaurants. So instead of opening up your own brick and mortar store with your name on the front and paying hundreds of thousands of dollars or even more for that storefront and permitting, instead, you're working in maybe 200 square feet in your own kitchen, but one that's within a larger kitchen space. So there might be 50 kitchens in a space. You're renting one. You could be next to Chick-fil-A and then maybe next to another mom and pop store. So it's a great way for individual restaurateurs to test out new concepts and see if new menus work, things like that. And that can help them get off the ground. Some people are using this to try to transition eventually once we're back into restaurants and back into dining rooms to see if they can make some of their concepts work and build up loyal followings. But it really is sort of the perfect solution for the pandemic and the explosion of takeout that we're all ordering right now.
All right. So you've got these ghost kitchens. How does venture get involved in something like this? Are they actually backing the space where the chefs come in, or are they backing the individual chefs, or in some cases, all from, you know, kitchen space to chef to delivery?
Venture capitalists are looking at the bigger ecosystem here. Restaurants are famously not a great investment. And so they're thinking about how can they invest in the backbone. So the cloud kitchens or the ghost kitchens themselves that are providing these spaces across the country and across the world. And a lot of this is really expensive to start up. You know, real estate takes a lot of money, whether you're buying a space and converting it or leasing it and renovating it to put in 50 ghost kitchens or more. So VCs are looking at the space and they're writing big checks because they're betting on growth, that this is a new way of ordering, not just in the pandemic, but for the future too. So they're investing in the companies themselves, and then these operators are going out and filling the spaces with mom and pop folks who are looking to start up restaurants or maybe move into this new model, as well as big national players. Some of Cloud Kitchen's customers include groups like Wendy's and Chick-fil-A. So it's certainly not just a play for the individual.
I think the idea is so funny because, you know, to your point about how restaurants have never really been a great investment, you know, the old joke is, do you want to be a millionaire, you know, open a restaurant with $1 billion and you'll get there really, really quickly. So let's talk a little bit about the one that Travis Kalanick is actually building, the Uber founder. So I'm sure he walked away with a huge amount of money in his pocket. He could have funded this all himself, but he's brought in the Sauds, who are, you know, famously investing everywhere. So first of all, what's going on there? Because it sounds from your story like this is not a place that people actually want to work.
There's a lot to unpack in this story. The first is who's involved here. So Travis, as you noted himself, walked away from Uber with a lot of money. He's a billionaire, likely multiple times over. He decided to invest some of that money that he made into Cloud Kitchens by buying about half of this company. So it existed before him, but he renamed it and took over as CEO And then he brought in his friend, Saudi Arabia's public investment fund, which is the sovereign wealth fund for the Gulf state. They're the investor that had really stood by his side during kind of the crisis that preceded his resignation at Uber. So it's a sort of a known character in the Travis world. And together, they're kind of funding this massive expansion of what was a small startup before Travis came in, just a handful of employees, a test location with plans for more, and they've totally supercharged it. So now we're talking about hundreds or thousands of locations across the world, thousands of employees with plans to really dominate this space. And they're not just buying real estate. They're also building up a whole tech side of the company. They've hired top engineers from Apple and Google and all the big names. And they're trying to basically aggregate all the orders that we place as consumers through DoorDash or Uber Eats and make a back end for restaurants. So if you, Elise, are going to open up a restaurant in Cloud Kitchens, you don't have to deal with all the tech side of things. You can just come in and start cooking, and they'll kind of take care of the tech side for you. So they're hiring big, both across Los Angeles and the Silicon Valley and elsewhere. And they're really making a big bet that this is the future of food. Despite all of that growth, employees aren't too happy. Many very much are and expect that they could make it big with this company. But my reporting showed that about 300 or more employees have left this year alone, and that number could be higher, especially in the coming months. These employees feel like, some of them told me, they feel like they're seeing a repeat of the worst of Uber's culture. They're expected to work incredibly long hours during the pandemic. Some of them told me they felt pressured to go in and work in the office, even when they're in corporate jobs where they don't really need to work in person and can be remote. They're not operating the kitchens themselves. And they feel like there's this kind of culture that's more like a frat house than a company or a corporate company. And some of them said it's just too much. They don't feel like the payday is going to be worth it. They're making below market rate salaries, and they've had enough. They've been there for a couple of years. They wanted to see Travis change, and they thought he had learned some lessons, but they're telling you over and over, they don't think anything's changed here. And so they're voting with their feet, and they're leaving.
So out of 300 employees, out of how many would you estimate? Because you mentioned in the story that they're so secretive, they don't even allow their employees to put the employment up on LinkedIn.
Exactly. I think that there are more than 2,000 employees at this company, and that's full-time employees. So we're not talking about people who work part-time at the Cloud Kitchens locations themselves. So there are a huge number of corporate employees, including many at their Los Angeles headquarters. So this is a pretty good chunk of staff that has walked out the door. And keep in mind, they've been promised that they could be millionaires or even more as this company gets going. So, you know, they're turning down what could be a lot of money because they say the culture just isn't right. And some of them are starting to doubt that their equity in the company will be worth anything someday as well.
Right. Well, you know, as we learned from WeWork, just because a company is big and scaling doesn't actually mean it's going to do well. Megan, I assume you've got the whole piece up on insider.com. Is that where people should go to read the full story?
Yes, they should go to Business Insider. They could Google Cloud Kitchens or Travis Kalanick or look for my name, Megan Morris. I'm pretty easy to find online.
All right. Well, Megan Morris is a senior reporter with Business Insider. You can find her at businessinsider.com. Thank you so much for joining us today. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
All right. When we come back, we're going to talk with Jim Delkey, senior editor at Chicago Inno, and of course with our very own Amy Guth. And we've got the Wintrust Business Minute later, so it's a packed half hour. Hope you'll stay with us. I'm Elise Glink. I do know my own name. I'm Elise Glink, sitting in for John. Back in a moment with more on 720 WGN. At this time on Mondays, we always talk with Jim Delkey. He's senior editor of Chicago Inno. You can find him at chicagoinno.com. Hey, Jim, how you doing today?
Hey, Elise, doing great. Thanks for having me.
Excellent. So there's a whole bunch of really interesting stories that are up about business, obviously, in Chicago. One of them really caught my eye, ActiveCampaign. We've got another unicorn here in Chicago. Pretty soon we're going to have to stop calling them unicorns because there are so many, right?
I know. And really, 2021 has been quite a year for Chicago tech. A lot of major fundraisers, a lot of big deals happening in the city. And Active campaign, really the latest one. So just last week, they raised $240 million, really major funding round for a Chicago tech company. That values them at over $3 billion. So Active Campaign, a marketing tech firm, help businesses send emails and automate different digital marketing initiatives. A major growth initiative for Active Campaign. They're not a new tech company. They were founded back in 2003, but in 2016, they had just 15 people. Fast forward to now, they have over 850, and they plan to be over 1,000 by the end of the year. So a really major growth story for Active Campaign.
Yeah, that is interesting. And it's a problem that I think everybody needs help with, which is, you know, designing and sending your newsletters and automating marketing, which for small businesses, these days, you're running so lean and clean that you don't have a lot of extra people around to do that kind of stuff. But also, technology has made it harder and harder to get through the channels and not be considered spam. So it sounds like they may have figured something out there.
Totally. And, you know, small businesses is a big piece of their customer growth. They actually have over 145,000 customers in 170 countries. So they really kind of run the gamut. They are all over the place. And kind of competing with the MailChimps and those of the world. So a really interesting company here in Chicago. They were bootstrapped for a while, just started raising funding within the last few years, and have sort of quickly become, you know, one of the premier tech companies in Chicago.
Which is really great to see. All right, let's switch to another one. S2G Ventures, they've been investing in food businesses, as you note, across the supply chain, and they've been around since 2014. But what's new with them?
Yeah, so, you know, kind of coinciding with Earth Day last week, really wanted to dive into S2G Ventures investment plan. Really what's interesting about them, you know, they invest in food and agriculture startups. They're actually a fund led by the former founder of Open Table, Chuck Templeton. And, you know, they have been on an absolute tear. They have raised over $1 billion since they were founded in 2014. We reported exclusively in this story that they quietly raised a new fund last year at $550 million. So really, you know, a ton of money here in Chicago's backyard for food and ag businesses. And, you know, what's really interesting about S2G Ventures is they also have recently raised a separate fund, a $100 million fund, specifically focused on oceans and seafood. Really, really interesting initiative investing in, you know, kind of companies that are really targeting, you know, this sector, sustainable seafood, ocean health. You know, there's really nothing in the United States like that. And they have $100 million dedicated specifically for companies that fit that sector. So, you know, really, you know, good news for Chicago, right? If you're a food business, if you're an ag business, in the city of Chicago, that there's a VC fund that has, you know, raised $1 billion in capital that they're ready to deploy.
Yeah, what I find really interesting about that, Jim, is that, you know, I'm seeing a lot more interest in investing in what we eat, how we make it, how we get it to market, and what are some innovative ways that we can get it there. I know that there are some small companies that are doing vertical farming, and they're renting out industrial spaces around Chicago. You know, my personal feeling is that there are so many neighborhoods that are in a food desert that could really use that kind of a growth, and seeing these kinds of venture firms backing those kinds of small businesses and helping them get off the ground. That's very encouraging.
Certainly. Another Chicago business that actually S2G has invested in is Hazel Technologies. They're based in Chicago. Really interesting startup. It created essentially a packet that can be placed in any food supplier's produce to extend the shelf life of fruits and vegetables. So that's one of the portfolio companies that S2G Ventures has invested in, and a really big growth for that company. They just raised $70 million a couple weeks ago,
which is pretty impressive as well. And then you've got a story about an Illinois startup that might actually get some airtime if we actually have the Olympics.
That's right. So a little known company downstate in Peoria called Natural Fiber Welding, a really interesting material sciences company. They have received an investment last year from Ralph Lauren, and they have developed a plant-based leather product that Ralph Lauren is really interested in. And what they're doing is including that technology on Team USA's Olympic closing ceremonies uniform. So a little hard to see from far away, but if you look at the uniforms up close, there's a little small plant-based leather patch. It's on the back of the denim uniform that the USA athletes will be wearing during the closing ceremonies. It says, you know, official Team USA Polo Ralph Lauren, and that is going to be actually made by the startup Natural Fiber Welding. So really cool that a local startup, an Illinois startup, is going to have a little FaceTime, so to speak, at the closing ceremonies.
What I thought was so interesting about this, and the product, by the way, for everybody listening, is called Mirum, M-I-R-U-M. It uses hemp, waste cork, coconut, and other products to mimic the look and feel of real leather. And for anybody who's ever tried on, like, a plastic version of leather, right, pleather, it's really hot and sticky, and this sounds like it might actually breathe a little bit, just like natural leather does.
That's right, and that's their whole deal is, you know, really creating a product that's very similar to traditional leather. They also have a range of different kinds of materials. They also have a recycled cotton product that they're working on as well. So really innovative product, really innovative startup downstate in Peoria.
Well, all of that is so interesting. And, of course, you go much deeper into all of these stories and more at ChicagoInno.com. And I hope everybody goes there and takes a look. There are some really terrific stories and very encouraging for all of the small businesses out there that are fighting to come out of this pandemic. Right, Jim?
Exactly. Yeah. No better time to be in Chicago's startup community than right now.
That's great. Jim Delke is senior editor with Chicago Inno. Find him and the stories at ChicagoInno.com. Thanks so much, Jim. Talk to you next week.
Thanks, Elise.
All right. It is time for Steve Grzanich with the Wintrust Business Minute.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. Humboldt Park and South Shore are two of the latest neighborhoods targeted by City Hall for redevelopment. Cranes reports the city has issued 3 requests for proposals for 2 blocks in Humboldt Park and 2 sites near the former Southworks steel plant in South Shore. The goal of the $750 million program is to revitalize commercial corridors in those neighborhoods where investment has been lacking or non-existent. The plan aims to steer more public funding, resources, and incentives into a total of 10 South and West Side communities. Today's the day Bona Beef goes beefless. For a limited time only, all 24 Bona Beef restaurants will add a meatless beef sandwich. The meat is replaced by a plant-based product that Bona says tastes just the same. Everything else in the sandwiches will remain the same. The meatless sandwiches will be prepared with separate packaging and utensils to ensure no cross-contamination. A 7-inch sandwich will cost $8. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
And, Steve, what about agribusiness?
Are you a fan of pretzels, Elise?
You bet I am.
National Pretzel Day today.
Ones. Ooh.
Oh, yeah, national. I like those big ones, nice and warm, no salt. Smear of peanut butter or hummus, maybe.
I like do you like the peanut butter stuffed ones or perhaps?
Oh, I haven't tried those yet.
Oh, those are good. Mm-hmm. Deadly.
Or cinnamon sugar, too.
Mm-hmm. And some beer cheese with that, too.
In other words, we're just going to seg right into a pretzel and beer cheese dip sort of segment.
Perfect.
Take that away for you.
Actually not. We're going to talk about cows. I was listening to WGN Radio News on Friday, and who else but Dr. Fauci was on talking about research on over-the-counter COVID medications, and he talked about cows.
Which is an interesting trial of a polyclonal antibody that has been derived from the immunization of transgenic cows.
Well, anytime we get a chance to highlight the contributions of agriculture to the greater good, I'm all in. So I phoned an expert to help us out.
Dr. Matt Wheeler, University of Illinois, Department of Animal Sciences.
And he says the science labs at the U of I are one place where genes are engineered to create these transgenic cattle.
The most recent one is the CRISPR system, or you might have heard it referred to as gene editing.
At the U of I, it's done mostly for agricultural purposes, but in the over-the-counter COVID medication Dr. Fauci was talking about, a protein is edited out of the cow's DNA and...
And then collect the antibodies from the blood from the animals, and then basically produce the material that they would use to treat patients.
I am presenting a very distilled explanation, but the point is, agriculture shows again why it's the world's most essential industry. And there's more to come, both for fighting disease in humans and in animals.
Yeah, I think this is the technology in the next 10 to 15 years is really going to be, you know, more and more frequent, more and more common. I think the exciting part as an agriculturalist is, you know, being able to improve the quality of meat, milk, and fiber for consumers to improve the health of the animals.
Including being able to prevent such destructive diseases as African swine fever and bird flus, transgenic cows. To the markets we go at the Chicago Board of Trade. Big, big numbers once again today. Wheat is trading 25 cents higher, $7.38 a bushel. Beans are up 21 at $15.37. And corn's trading 23 cents higher at $6.55. And that's your money on 720 WGN.
But in the meantime, or to fill the gap, we should say, we've got Amy Guth, WGN radio reporter. Hey, Amy, how are you?
Hey, Elise, how's it going today?
Things are good. It's beautiful out, right?
I know. It's finally, it's beautiful outside.
It's finally spring. Well, actually, we've had the best spring I can remember my whole life. It just makes everything a little bit cheerier. You know, I talked earlier about how Apple had announced its first East Coast campus and it was going to end up in North Carolina. And I figured you might have some thoughts about or why they chose North Carolina of all places.
You know, that Research Triangle area in Raleigh-Durham is already, there's so much going on there. There's so many tech companies that have a foot there, that have, you know, some kind of presence there. It makes a lot of sense for Apple, for a lot of tech companies to have a presence there as well. There's a lot of support from North Carolina. The governor has called this transformational. They're going to get quite a bit in tax credits and tax incentives for doing this. It'll be, quite a bit in the millions just for this relocation. They're also going to be establishing, once there, they're establishing $100 million fund to support schools and community initiatives in that area. So it seems just, you know, very much win-win for that area. That said, they are also expanding existing teams in Colorado, Massachusetts, Texas, Washington, New York, and California. So even their headquarters in California, that's going to grow too. They have said they want to come back bigger than ever post-pandemic, that they want to really use that time and the momentum of the economic recovery to expand in a really meaningful way. And I think they're doing it.
Well, I noticed on that list that you read off, Colorado, Massachusetts, Texas, Washington, New York, California, hello, Midwest and Chicago. What about us?
I know, right? They do have a distribution center near Indianapolis, but not, you know, I wondered that too. I thought, hey, what are we chop liver over here? We've got a lot of things going on. What's interesting to me, my hunch is the presence in Massachusetts, because that's the spot that really has like the biotech in terms of genetics, right? You have MIT, you've got Harvard right there. A lot of those, like 23andMe, a lot of their research groups are based right around that area. So I wonder if that's, you know, a tell. I think a lot of industry observers have been trying to kind of read the tea leaves of these different locations where the expansions are happening, saying, oh, that means they're going to come out with a product like this, or that means they're going to do this. You know, I wouldn't be surprised if that Massachusetts move of expansion does have something to do with biotech, maybe for the Apple Watch. There's so many health benefits, you know, that people track in the Apple Watch. So it could be something like that. But I know I kind of felt a little left out, like our invitation got lost in the mail here to the Apple party in Chicago.
Well, we put it forward when they were, you know, when Amazon was looking to build their second headquarters. And I got to say, it made all the sense in the world, you know, after Bezos had actually bought a $20 million mansion or whatever in D.C.
Right.
to actually relocate the company there. But I thought we put together in the state a pretty competitive package. But the truth is that, you know, we've got such a bad rap in terms of taxes that you can imagine why some of these, I mean, Google is an exception because they already announced they were going to build another big, big building here. But it feels like some of the other tech companies maybe are a little scared.
Yeah, it very well could be that, you know, and I think there's a lot of people watching that right now. Where we have really excelled is in shipping logistics. You know, we've seen Amazon snap up a ton of space. We've seen Wayfair and Target really double down on space in this area. And so I think, you know, Chicago's always had that reputation of like, we do the logistics part really well. When you apply tech to that, I think that's kind of building on what Chicago's doing. So who knows, maybe one day we will have an Apple footprint here.
Well, I'd love to see it. That's for sure. Changing, instead of bringing people in, we're going to be shipping people out to the EU, it sounds like. The EU is saying that they're going to allow U.S. tourists back this summer. And kudos to some friends of ours who actually bought $350 business class tickets to Portugal for June, wow, betting that if they lost, they would lose their $700, and if they won, they'd get a fabulous trip.
Wow, that's a pretty good bet. Well, the EU Commission, which is the executive arm of the EU, they are meeting to discuss. They're soon going to release a proposal to the member states of the EU. They didn't say exactly when, but that the proposal is going to propose that American tourists who can either produce proof that they've been vaccinated or have a negative test could be allowed in. What we don't know is whether that's reciprocal. Is that dependent on the US also lifting some travel restrictions against people coming from those countries? That's unknown. And again, we don't know the exact timeline for that or what that kind of proof of vaccination would look like. Is that the card? Is that some kind of other product like a vaccine passport? That part is all unknown. But I think the airlines especially have been so hurting for that international travel revenue. That's such a big piece of the pie anyway for them. So the International Air Transport Association, which is a trade group that represents 290 airlines, immediately applauded the news and really got behind this and really supported this. They called it a step in the right direction.
I gotta tell you, Amy, I looked at the fact that 150 of those vaccine cards were stolen. But
yeah,
when I had my second shot and they marked it down, that I had it, I thought, this little piece of paper, this is what they're going to use around the world to tell us that we were actually, we've been vaccinated. It's so easy to fake. Right?
I know. I know. And I, as I've seen reports as you have of fraudulent vaccine cards and things like that. First of all, that seems like such a risky thing to lie about, to try to duplicate and deceive people on. And yet here we are, we're seeing that. So I don't know. I mean, there's talks of various tech companies have considered some kind of, universal product of what that would look like. Some airlines have even kind of gotten behind that. I know United was testing some various methods of how to do that. And so it would be like one app, everybody's got to have it. But then we get into accessibility issues. What about people that don't have a smartphone? What about people in remote areas without Wi-Fi, things like that? So I think there's so many questions. There's certainly more questions and answers at this point, but we'll see.
I know that I'd like to be sitting on a beach in Greece or Portugal or, in a museum
here.
In Rome. So let's keep our fingers crossed that before the end of the year, they can all work it out, right?
That's exactly right.
All right. Amy Guth, WGN radio reporter. Thank you. As always, a font of wisdom.
Thanks so much, Elise.
Have a good one.
You too.